statement of calendar is 99963, State of Ohio Trail, Ohio Association of Public School Employees versus Batavia Local School District. Mr. Mellis, Mr. Mellis.
May I please report to select and serve 3 minutes for the vote?
Does me really have to do this?
The collective bargaining is a labor case. The collective bargaining thing in this case was between the local divisions, a decertified bargaining representative and the local school district. And we can see right up front that the collective bargaining agreement had laid off the board in it. But that doesn't end the question. That begins this case. The school board executed a contract with Laidlaw Transit Inc. to contract out the bargaining unit work, transportation work that we have historically done and has been part of our deemed certified bargaining unit since before the enactment of the collective bargaining law. As soon as that happened, we wrote a letter to the school board and we said to them, now that you've contracted out, you still have the obligation to recognize our statutory employment contracts, that is, of the individual relators under 3319.081, and you also have the obligation to recognize that we are the deemed certified collective bargaining representative, and you must still recognize us as the bargaining representative of those employees, and that you remain as the public employer in this case, even though you have contracted out to Laidlaw. We received no response from the board to that letter, nor will we commence this action.
Okay, let me stop you there, Mr. Mellie. I'd have to be convinced that this is appropriately a mandamus action. This is a mandamus action. It seems to me that in a lot of cases that we traditionally say you go through the usual appellate procedures are no longer would require that. Convince me that this is appropriately a mandamus action.
Your Honor, we are suing to enforce statutory remedies. Statutory remedies involve are the statutory rights and remedies are section 3319.081. That's the statute that says non-teaching employees in a local or exempted village school district that the employees have the statutory employment contracts and the right not to be terminated from employment except for cause. This is an issue that, for example, the court dealt with in the Springfield and Boggs case back in 1998. The second item that properly says that this is a mandamus case is that we're talking about the interpretation of the union's rights under Section 4A of amended substitute Senate Bill number 133. That is, are we the deemed certified collective bargaining representative? And if we are, there's only one way we can be displaced from our right to represent this transportation work no matter where it goes. And that is that we can only be displaced by the language in the statute that says when a competing labor organization challenges us and displaces us according to the terms of the statute. That has not happened in this case. It's undisputed that we have not been challenged by a labor organization.
Well, but in a declaratory judgment action, you can get all of that said to your benefit, can you not?
Your Honor, I think that this court has held that a declaratory judgment action is not an adequate remedy for to bar mandamus relief if you still have to come back and seek additional relief. That we would have to then ask the court still issue an injunction, either a mandatory injunction or a mandamus to compel them to recognize our statutory rights under Section 4A, that we have the right to represent the work that's now been contracted out to Laidlaw. We would also have to have a mandamus action to compel them to recognize the statutory employment contract rights of the individual relators.
If you have a court saying these are your rights and these are your rights or obligations, we do that all the time. We don't have injunctions and other actions to tell parties. Now, we told you, you're parties in this case, we told you what the law is. We don't mandamus people and or even public agencies to enforce orders, do we? When the court states what the law is, this is what you're obligated to do, is follow what the court said.
I think that this court has said on several occasions that where there is a violation of a mandatory statutory duty, even if there might be some other form of release, that is not a bar to bringing a mandamus action. This court said it in Walker. They said it in the Pointer's Company's case. I cited about the Athens case. We cited about six cases in our brief. Will you have ruled that? I think almost without dissent. The court may be of the view that perhaps there are too many of these cases getting to the court in terms of because we have an automatic right of appeal, but we're dealing with we satisfy the elements for a collective, for mandamus action, and I think that the declaratory judgment just isn't going to do it. We still have to force them. We've asked them right up front. We asked them in our letter, just do what the statute said you're supposed to do. Law said you're supposed to, that they are supposed to recognize their statutory rights. Well, they didn't do that. And in the meantime, by the time this takes to get through the court, we have employees that are not represented. The late law won't recognize us as the bargaining representative of these employees, that is the deemed certified bargaining representative. Late law doesn't recognize these employees that have the statutory contracts. So they're essentially employees at will during all this period of time.
What is your argument with regard to Article 13 in the agreement that specifically provides for abolishment of jobs, layoff, or lack of funds, or lack of work?
Your Honor,
because they took the action to abolish the jobs.
Yes. Your Honor, we do not contest the validity of the layoffs in this case. The question is, now what? Once the layoffs have taken place, now what? That's what this case is all about. Where is our right to have enforced our Section 4A rights to represent these employees, and where do the employees have their statutory employment contract recognized? This case, in no way, that was the problem the Court of Appeals made. They felt that because there was layoff language in the collective bargaining agreement, that somehow that preempted everything. But, and then we had no rights, and the Court of Appeals never addressed the deemed certified issue. But the layoff, the right to lay off employees and the right to have a
abolishment. An abolishment of the jobs.
Either one doesn't preempt our statutory employment rights under 3319.081. This court has ruled again.
We said that in our most recent case, did we not?
With very little disagreement among the members of the court.
And doesn't that control this case?
In which one, Boggs?
Mm-hmm.
I think Boggs controls to this extent. There's one difference between this case and Boggs. In Boggs, there was no collective bargaining agreement in effect. Here, there is a collective bargaining agreement in effect.
Well, it had expired in Boggs.
Yes, it had expired. Here, also in Boggs, the collective bargaining agreement has some language in it preempting 3319.081. So if you go back and read your opinion, this court notes that there was such language. Here, there is no language preempting 3319.081. And this court has ruled that under the preemption language in section 4117.10a, that unless there's a direct conflict of a matter that's addressed in the collective bargaining agreement and a matter that's addressed by the statute, they both apply. And so we have both rights under the collective bargaining agreement and we have rights under the statute that apply in this case.
How did you
that's a great question.
That's
a great question.
And the second question would be, if they took them out of the fifth void and worked for the late law, they went and worked for the code abutments, would they still have all their statutes for the as a public employee if they went for the code?
That's a good question, Your Honor. First of all, on how do they become employees after they are laid off? The answer is because the statute 4117.01c defines a public employee as anyone who is employed by the board or working in the service of the board. We have our statutory employment contracts, which they admit have not been terminated. And while we have been laid off, the board then executes a contract with Laidlaw. When they execute a contract with Laidlaw, the board also arranged for all of our drivers to be hired by Laidlaw. So now we are working pursuant to the school board's contract with Laidlaw, and by definition, under 4117.01c, that makes us a public employee all over again. As I said, this case must be approached after the layoff.
Our argument with Laidlaw is basically a sham agent.
Well, we're not saying sham, Your Honor. We're saying that by definition, 4117.01c, we meet the definition of public employee after the layoff. So we are back again with statutory rights.
So your theory then can to whatever contract out it was.
That's not a question presented by this case.
Right.
And if we rule it, will we effectively say,
you're not,
government entity really can't
prioritize
anything?
Your Honor, I would hesitate to make such a sweeping generalization because there are all kinds of factors involved, including what's bargained at the table in subsequent contracts. What are the implications of the union's deemed certified rights and how the court views there's two sets of rights involved here, not just the individual employee's contract rights. We also have the rights of our union policy. We're the deemed certified collective bargaining agent. We can't be displaced. Yet what they have done is they displace us. We have nobody to represent. We have no work to represent. We have no dues to collect. We have no grievances to file over transportation because they contract it out. We look at it from the other point of view, they kill us.
So you're basically arguing you can't privatize.
I don't know how it's going to play out in the future, Your Honor, but certainly there are not just one-sided rights here. The union has significant rights under Section 4A.
What services were provided by Laidlaw?
Laidlaw provides what they call transportation services, which includes the furnishing of buses, mechanics, maintenance.
Weren't they using the school's buses?
To a degree they are, Your Honor. The contract is a phase-in situation whereby they use, I think in the initial term, about 11 of the school's buses, and they use about two or four of their own, and then they gradually go like this where it's all Laidlaw buses and no school
and
buses.
And they use the school's drivers?
After the layoff, in connection with the layoff, what the school board did is, the school board worked hand-in-hand with Laidlaw. Negotiated with Laidlaw for the hiring, Laidlaw for the hiring of our drivers. They negotiated the drivers' wages when they got hired over there. They negotiated their terms and conditions of employment, their fringe benefits, and then somehow they say that they don't have any connection to the employees.
And the board was still providing the school the routes and the times of pickups and so forth, weren't they?
We meet the second part of the definition of public employee as well after the layoffs. Because here we have the statute says anybody that is working pursuant to a contract between a public employer, the school board, and a private employer, Laidlaw, is still a public employee. And this court addressed that issue in the city of Hamilton case, talking about where the right of control is. And we have demonstrated in our brief that the right of control is so extensively in the state of Ohio, it's not even in the respondent board of education. The state of Ohio, the statutes, the administrative rules and regulations, the Department of Highway Safety, the Department of Education, they all tell the school board and our drivers what they can do and how they can do it. There is no authority in Laidlaw to make any independent decisions or even in the dissenting opinion in the city of Hamilton case, the Chief Justice and Justice Wright focused on the ability to negotiate bargaining terms. Laidlaw is not even a public employer, and therefore, if we were to bargain with Laidlaw in the private sector, we couldn't bargain over the change of any statutory or administrative rules or regulations in this case, because any agreement with them would have no authority to preempt anything. Your Honor, my time's up on this one.
Can you figure out what Laidlaw provides?
Thank you, Mr. Milley. McCord.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the state and local board of education, and Bob is completely appealing in this case. In Bob, as this court said, the majority opinion said that you first must decide, first inquiry is to decide whether the party's conduct is governed by the terms of the collective bargaining agreement or by the statute. In Bob, you have expired collective bargaining agreement, so the individual employees that indicated their rights that won't no longer be bound by the terms of that collective bargaining agreement. Consequently, they revert back to their rights under the statute. In the case at hand, we have a collective bargaining agreement that is in effect, and in effect, of February 29, 1999, well after this action was taken by the Board of Education. And something that should be noted here as well, while it's remarkably relevant, the Board had before he entered into this contract, offered to negotiate with OC on the effects of this, and that's contained in the affidavit of Jim Fite, the superintendent at the time, which is in the appellant's supplement. OC at every juncture refused.
They did that pursuant to the Lorraine case.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. But we're legally obligated to do so. But at every juncture, OC said, we are not going to negotiate with you, period. Consequently, we have the rights of the parties are determined by what is contained in the collective bargaining agreement. That collective bargaining agreement says that we can lay off and abolish positions. They admit we can lay off and abolish positions. In my mind, case closed. We can do that. Then where are we here? I don't understand. Now, they try to say to the white. Yes, sir.
Do you have a similar provision with your teachers?
Your Honor, I have no idea.
So under that provision, you can just abolish all of the work, and that's it.
Under the provision in the collective bargaining agreement with the non-teaching employees, we can abolish positions and lay off those non-teaching employees. No, there's only one collective bargaining agreement. That's with the non-teaching employees represented by OEA. There is another collective bargaining agreement in effect that's with OEA, which covers the teachers.
Right. But you can just abolish all the work, period, and people who have continuing contracts, that's done.
Your Honor, they sat down at the table and negotiated this provision. Yes, in fact, we can do that if we so chose. I don't know why they would, because obviously the district has to run unless they had something else in place which is going to allow them to perform the custodial work or perform the coaching work or perform the transportation work that needs to be performed by the board. They wouldn't do so. But the collective bargaining agreement that was negotiated by the two parties said if, in fact, you follow these provisions in the layoff and recall articles, you can then lay off the ball position, period. They sat down and negotiated that. The whole point of the collective bargaining agreement is to put people across the table from each other and let them determine the terms and conditions of their employment, regardless of who may be advantaged or disadvantaged by the terms of that negotiation.
And maybe that's why the General Assembly under 08-1 gave them some additional protections, because what you're saying now is, I think, you could abolish all the cafeteria workers' jobs and hire a private firm to come in and run the cafeteria. Obviously, you could. The maintenance workers in the schools, the people we used to call the boiler workers who tend to the furnaces, they could all be laid off, jobs abolished, and hired private people to do it. Now, don't they pick up some rights, so under 08-1? Now, before you start, I understand they didn't plead it. The Court of Appeals never decided this issue. Whether or not they are still public employees, because it seems to me what they do is just recognize the union again as their bargaining agent, and you're right back where you were, even though they work for Laidlaw, because they are public employees. They're going to continue to pay into PERS, aren't they?
Well, by law, they're required to pay into PERS.
Okay, that makes them public employees, doesn't it?
But if you look at that statute, it says for the purpose of this chapter, and look at the cases in North Canton, the city of Cincinnati, where you wrote, they talk about for the purpose of this chapter, the purpose of PERS only. So I would say those cases are limited to their facts. But they are. Their contracts have been suspended, if you will. We agree we didn't terminate their contracts. I've never said you did. What happens in a layoff provision, the operation of the contract is suspended until such time that the board decides to get back into the transportation business, at which point in time they do that, these employees who have been laid off would have all the rights under the recall provisions contained in the collective bargaining agreement. So, as far as the recall provisions of the collective bargaining agreement exist, they still have those contracts with the board, but the operational contract that has been superseded.
Well, what the right to be recalled? The right to be recalled to what? Bus driver positions that don't exist? Mechanics positions that don't exist?
If in fact the board decides to go back into the transportation business, then they will have to recall those drivers because that's what the collective bargaining agreement said. Yes. Now, when you look at that, the statutory employment contracts, I try to liken them to the skin. there and what holds it all together. Now, you have to determine, the inquiry is, what makes up the meat and the bone of the skin? Is it the statutory rights, which say you can't lay off employees, which say you can only terminate for certain reasons, or is it the collective bargaining rights, which specifically say you can lay off employees, or you can terminate for these other reasons, or you can have seniority rights. Now, I think we get caught up here on the board rights and this collective bargaining agreement. There are rights contained in that collective bargaining agreement that are above and beyond those required by the statute to protect non-union employees. They have seniority rights. They have rights to transfer, bidding in the job, and everything else. And this collective bargaining agreement, it goes both ways. Now, what you're going to be doing, in fact, you side with them in this matter, is simply saying to the people who negotiate this agreement, and to every single other district, board of education, or any other public employee who is negotiating these layoff provisions, in this collective bargaining agreement, it doesn't matter what you negotiate.
It seems to me the way the board handled this, it goes one way. It's just all gone. That's not. It would seem to me that these contracts are negotiated with the understanding of the part of the union employees, the change in the student population, efficiencies, larger buses, whatnot, may cause you to want to have a reduction in force. You may want to have bus drivers on the road 8 hours a day because of your schedule. And to deal with less drivers. They don't really contemplate, let's just get out of the business. Now, when you talk about it, and that's why I asked the question about the teacher. I assume your teaching contracts have a similar kind of arrangement where the teacher's union understands that there may need to be a reduction in force, and so it's an item of bargaining. And if that similar provision is there, then theoretically, your Board of Education could just contract out to Laidlaw. If Laidlaw decided to get in the teaching business, the whole business of teaching is put down.
Keep in mind, there's a reduction of force statute in place for teachers. There is no such statute that relates to non-teaching employees. But consequently, if you want to have a reduction of force, i.e. a layoff of non-teaching employees, you have to negotiate that. But if you don't, you don't have that right. So there's a distinct difference between the two. As far as what the parties contemplated, if in fact they said,
well, could you not do the same thing? Could you not just contract with all us?
Very well could. I don't know why they would.
The same theory applies all the way across the board.
If in fact the teachers can get teachers plus their bargaining
agreement. So then this whole, I mean, there is a huge argument about whether or not teachers in particular having continuing contracts, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So under your theory, you could just short-circuit that whole argument if the board decides that tenure is a bad thing.
If the board
somebody says, you know, we'll contract all the teaching in this school building, and we'll do it with folks who are not tenured, like some of your teachers.
I think we're talking about apples and oranges here, because what we're talking about, as far as the teachers are concerned, once again, there's a statute that says there's only certain instances where you can reduce the force of teachers. Unless you negotiate something above and beyond that, that's what it is. In this instance, we're talking about a statute that does not permit layoffs, period. Anomaly, oversight, I don't know. I'm not going to try to delve into the minds of the General Assembly why they didn't do that. But this provision is negotiated. Chapter 4117 is in place for a reason, to allow two parties to sit down at the table and negotiate what the terms and conditions of their relationship are going to be. And that's what happened here. We have a collective bargaining agreement that it's different than 32-19-081. It says it may be the law.
What benefits that bus driver's law by
law? Well, if you look at the news from the Lebanon situation, I would say none. Those drivers in that situation. But what happened here is that they got a raise. the board had some sense of loyalty, did in fact say to Laidlaw, we want you to offer our employees a job. They're the first person you have to offer a job. They didn't have to take it. It could go and work for anybody else. There's plenty of bus driver jobs we had out there. But Laidlaw said, okay, fine, we will do that. In order to have a contract with you, we will negotiate. We will offer them jobs. They gave them a 3% raise. They decided to maintain their insurance coverage. They agreed to maintain their insurance coverage at 100% until February 1999, at which point in time Laidlaw could have done whatever they wanted to do as far as insurance coverage goes.
What's the point at which initially Laidlaw agreed to maintain, and then at a certain point Laidlaw's own policy rules went into effect?
As far as fringe benefits are concerned, it's after a certain point, so completely up to Laidlaw to decide who gets paid what, how, when, where.
Wasn't this an end run then around the union by the school board sending it out to Laidlaw? The school board can, in effect, get rid of the union's power and benefits for the employees to cut the benefits.
I don't think it was a cut in benefits, Your Honor. And I still go back
to.
Laidlaw do whatever they want. They're the employer. We're not the employer. Laidlaw has the ultimate control. They're funded completely by themselves. They're multinational corporations that make the decisions whether or not to hire, fire, what fringe benefits are going to be awarded or anything else. They're the employer. That is correct. We can't.
So the school board eventually has the benefit of all of your work. You just doesn't have to worry about the benefits of the union.
I would say the school board has the benefit of having a professional company perform the transportation services that the board is obligated by statute to perform. That's the situation. Now, I'd like to move on to the deemed certified issue. Number one, I would say to you that I don't think an alteration occurred here. If you look at the supplement provided by the Daily Board of Education, which contains the new collective bargaining agreement, bus drivers are still listed as included within that the bargaining agreement. So if, in fact, the board would go back into the business of transportation, then the bus drivers that are hired would, in fact, be still included within the bargaining unit. But regardless, I think just contrary to what the panelists have stated, this court's opinion, to me, in Drexville, is very clear. You limited Ohio County duty to its facts. You said the General Assembly did not intend a slavish adherence to the status quo by virtue of Section 4A of Amendment 0133. It was meant to protect the certification, not the composition. In this instance, OT still represents every single other non-teaching employee of the district, the cooks, the custodians, the maintenance people, every single one of them. It's not like they're out the door. They were simply not representing the bus drivers anymore because we don't have any bus drivers. So, don't prompt your Argentina on this one. They're still there. I know Justice Stubbs and Justice Resnick in the concurring opinion indicated that in Brexit that they thought the composition was intended to be protected. However, the concurring opinion very clearly said that this doesn't mean that a joint agreement could not adjust or alter this composition. In this situation, we've got a joint agreement. We've got a collective bargaining agreement that says, so long as you follow these provisions, you can lay off these people. You can adjust the composition of this farming unit. And that's what's occurred here. Now, we can't lose sight of the fact that we're talking about a collective bargaining agreement. We can't lose sight of the fact that this Chapter 4117 is supposed to be liberally construed for a efficient operation and constructive relationship between the two parties. These two parties sat down and negotiated a collective bargaining agreement that let them lay people off. And I can assure you that there are more collective bargaining agreements out there that say exactly the same thing.
But, Counselor, let's be fair about it. In Boggs, we never decided the issue that you argue. That is, we never decided whether or not an agreement's general provision could supersede 081, did we?
I think that might sound to you. I'll answer your question.
Okay.
What you said in Boggs was this, if I may even speak, my opinion or interpretation of the court said, that The first inquiry must be what governs their rights. A collective bargaining agreement or the statute. Long the collective bargaining agreement had expired. The people had indicated their intent no longer be bound by the terms of that agreement. Consequently, they revert back to the statutory rights.
Yeah, we understand all that.
If you look at it from the converse, then if in fact a collective bargaining agreement is in effect, then the rights of the party and the conduct of the party is governed by the terms and conditions of that collective bargaining agreement.
Okay. Fine. Now, Boggs did not say, however, that the general provisions of an agreement can, in fact, supersede 081, did it? Because otherwise you could reach an absurd result. What you're saying is where you have a collective bargaining agreement, then you could abolish all the jobs. But if you don't have any, you can't abolish any.
That's essentially what Boggs says.
No, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. I don't. Well, we just disagree, that's all.
417 says that if you have a collective bargaining agreement that's different from or conflicts with the statutes in place, then that collective bargaining.
We did what we did in Boggs because the collective bargaining agreement had expired, and that was the issue presented to us. Where there is no effective collective bargaining agreement, what are the results? Here there is an effective collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
But would you concede, would you at least agree that it's arguable that your position leads to the result that if you have a collective bargaining agreement, you can abolish all these jobs. But if you have none, you can't abolish any of them.
If your collective bargaining agreement gives you the power to abolish jobs, then yes, you can. And if it doesn't, okay, then there's no conflict.
And then, therefore, the General Assembly's intent with regard to protection of employees under 081 is a nullity.
Well, you're assuming, of course, they left that layoff provision out for the general protection. They could have been simple omission on their part. I don't know. I don't have the legislative history in front of me. I don't think this we were having it this time either.
You've used your time, Mr. McCord.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, you've saved about a minute and a half of
your
time.
Counsel, if you decide to refuse, what is the practical effect? What happens to the status of the
The practical effect is for this court to interpret what happened. And if there's one thing I'd like the court to take away from this argument is that this case doesn't begin or end with a layoff authority. That this case begins after the layoff authority is exercised. What does the court do with the situation that's in front of it after the layoff? The statutory definition of public employee in 4117.01c is what controls. It says if you are working in the service of a public employer which has a contract with a private employer, you are a public employee. The court doesn't have to make any decision on this. The General Assembly has already made it. So the practical effect is that these employees are public employees as long as the late law contract is in effect. Now the question is, will they cancel the late law contract? Will they renew it? It's in for 5 years, about 2 years or so have already passed, so 3 years to go. I mean, what we know for a fact is that for the next 3 years, if you side with us, that we will have the right to represent these employees and that they will be public employees now. If they continue the contract, they're ruined. After your decision, it would be the way it would work would be the board would be the public employer. We would continue to bargain with the board over these employees, even though they are theoretically working for Laidlaw. So, yes, they would still be employees of the board as they are right now.
And your theory would be all of their benefits, negotiations, contracts would come back regardless of
the contract. Your Honor, they have their benefits in effect now. If you find that they are public employees, they're governed by our collective bargaining agreement that's in effect right now. What Laidlaw did and what these people did has no effect on anything. That's the whole point of this case. They don't have the right to take this work and pass it out to somebody else and ignore us. Justice Douglas mentioned about the Lorraine case and the fact that they sent us a letter and said they'll bargain the effects of this. Lorraine says they have to bargain the decision and the effects. They didn't talk to us about the decision. They went ahead and did whatever they wanted to do.
How is Laidlaw going to take that the idea that the wages and the routes and the, you know, whatever you're going to bargain with the school board about is going to control their, in theory, their employees, they're the folks who are writing the checks, I guess.
That was my point earlier. Maybe I didn't do a very good job of making it, but if we were to negotiate a labor agreement with Lake Law, we can't affect anything.
No, no. I understand that, but you said, so what would happen is there'd be this bargaining with the school board about these employees who get paid by somebody else and work, in theory, respond to someone else, but there'd be these other deals going on.
We would have to bargain. The result of your decision would be, first of all, to find that they are public employees. Then, once that decision is found, they are covered by our collective bargaining agreement, and we are their representative. What Lake Law does or doesn't do is irrelevant. Lake Law has to work with us as the school board has to work with us. We'll have to find some accommodation. When Justice Stratton asked, what's the practical effect? Is this a prohibitive privatizing? I don't know where this goes, Judge. This is an evolving issue that's going to last for at least another 10 or 15 years. None of us know where this is going. We only know that once they contract out, what happens? What happens is that we can't be ignored, that we have rights as their union representative. We have our statutory employment contracts. The definition of public employees applies, and that's what the fact is for now.
How big is Mr. Personnel? I'm trying to also see the impact of this. What if we reverse the Court of Appeals in your favor, what is left of the school board from this contract that says they can abolish the job? What is left to them? Do they still have some benefit from that provision? Or
as a matter of fact, that was thinking, Your Honor, because when I filed my motion request tomorrow night, I suggested to the court this really is a win-win situation for everybody. The position that we are advocating, quite frankly, benefits them, and that is what they want to do is they want to contract out with Lake Law. And the solution that we have suggested to you, which is fully consistent with every precedent you have written and every statute that's on the books, is to identify us as public employees under 4117.01c. We meet both definitions, although we don't have to. That's number one. Number two, that still recognizes that they have the right to contract out with Lake Law, so the Lake Law contract is still in effect. Number three, you find under Section 4A of the collective bargaining bill that we are the deemed certified representative and we can't be displaced the way that they did it because we were not challenged by another labor organization. Therefore, we are still the union representing the drivers and we still are the union that has the jurisdiction and authority over the transportation bargaining unit work and we can still bargain with the board. Everybody has exactly what they want. The only thing is they want to ship us out to the union and the drivers as being essentially at-will employees, or if we get an agreement with Lake Law, that we still can't bargain over anything. That's the effect. That's really what's involved here. I tried to make the point before that if we reach an agreement with Lake Law, we cannot preempt any statute, any administrative rule, any term and condition of employment, because we can only have the law under 4117.10a is that that only a public employer and a public or any labor organization, when they reach an agreement, can have the effect of preemption. Lake Law is not a public employer.
Are any of the people that were displaced not employees of Lake Law?
I believe, Your Honor, that although I've lost intimate contact with the drivers down there, I believe that they are all still working for Lake Law.
All right, so to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, there's no economic impact here. Because you ask for reinstatement and back pay. There really isn't any if they've been continuing and gotten a 3% raise. There's no economic impact.
And Justice Stratton asked the same question, Your Honor. We, in our supplement, tab 25 and tab 20 through 23, we have laid out the economic harm. See, but everybody talks about this privatizing, they talk about the 3%, but they forget what they do, they cut the benefits. In this case, they cut the life insurance benefit of these drivers from $50,000 down to $25,000.
That's my point.
We negotiated, and the statutes provide that you accumulate 1.25 hours of sick leave.
Okay, you don't have to go through all that. We understand that there's going to be some economic impact. That's what I wanted. Now, my second major concern, this is the major concern, it seems to me that you have also filed, or the certified representative has filed, pursuant to the grievance procedure in the contract, a grievance that is now scheduled for arbitration. Why wouldn't that be the proper remedy as opposed to an action under 081?
Your Honor, the grievance can only be filed by the individual bargaining unit members. This contract, for some strange reason, doesn't allow the union to file a grievance. grievance on its own behalf. Only the individuals came.
Well, some have already filed it. That's in the record.
There is an agreement, but the agreement will only grievance and arbitration issue will only affect the decision to contract out. It doesn't at all deal with what happens after.
Has a grievance and arbitration issue yet been decided?
No, it has not.
Thank you.
The arbitrator cannot interpret any statutes. He can only interpret the collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, the arbitrator can never address the issues that are in this case. And if he were to do that, there would be a motion by them, and we were successful, there would be a motion by them to vacate the arbitration board on the grounds that he exceeded his authority.
You've used your time, Mr. Miller. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.